In the stillness of a cold November night at Moscow, Idaho, an off-campus house became the stage of a horror no college town had seen in years. Four promising students, Kaylee, Madison, Zana, and Ethan, slept within these whitewashed walls. The world outside was quiet, unaware, until shortly after 4 a.m., when tragedy struck. A masked intruder wielding a K-bar knife silently ended their futures, leaving two roommates to live with eternal questions. This was not a random act. It was an invasion of safety, trust, and innocence. 30 days later, investigators would arrest Brian Koberger, a 30-year-old Ph.D. criminology student with a spine-chilling connection, DNA from a knife sheath. His journey from academic halls to a courtroom suspect would raise uncomfortable legal and ethical questions. Now, on July 2, 2025, Koberger has shocked families and a nation. He's expected to plead guilty and avoid the death penalty. No trial, no public reckoning, no full airing of truths. So if you think you've heard it all, you haven't. Hit follow on your favorite platform and leave us a comment, because the next story might just change the way you see everything. Don't miss a single twisted turn. It was the kind of house you passed without thinking. Three stories high, tucked on the edge of campus life in the quiet college town of Moscow, Idaho. The white siding looked weathered by seasons of laughter, late-night cramming, and spontaneous parties. Known to students simply as the House on King Road, it sat surrounded by trees, with a view just secluded enough to feel private but open enough to never seem threatening. It was a home meant for memories, not for death. Inside, four students were trying to live their version of the American college dream. Kaylee Goncalves, a vibrant, fearless senior with a contagious laugh, was preparing for life after graduation. She had just adopted a golden doodle named Murphy and was planning to move to Texas. Her best friend, Madison Mogan, equally charismatic and warm, was inseparable from her. The two had grown up together, and now, in their final semester, they were roommates, soul sisters, and a constant presence on each other's social feeds. Zana Kernodle, a junior with a sharp wit and laid-back charm, had stayed in that night with her boyfriend Ethan Chapin, a tall, goofy triplet who had joined them after a fraternity event. The six-bedroom house was filled with remnants of youth, post-it notes on the fridge, perfume on the dressers, energy drinks lining the shelves. It was messy in the way young freedom is messy. Life was blooming there. The night of November 12, 2022, started out normal. Kaylee and Maddie went to a downtown bar called the Corner Club. Surveillance footage shows them laughing, texting, brushing hair behind their ears as they chatted up friends. They returned home by 1:56 a.m. after grabbing food from a nearby truck. Zana and Ethan had been at a Sigma Chi party just across campus, returning around 1:45 a.m. Everything was familiar, ordinary, safe. Two other roommates, Bethany and Dylan, were also home. They had gone to bed earlier, nestled in separate parts of the house. By 4 a.m., all lights were off. Silence crept in like it always did on that side of town. But someone was watching. A figure entered the house sometime between 4 a.m. and 4:15 a.m. No broken windows, no forced doors. He slipped in through a sliding glass door on the second floor, wearing all black, carrying a fixed blade knife. He moved like a shadow, his presence felt only by the air shifting around him. What happened next is still a subject of forensic reconstruction. What we do know, based on autopsy reports and digital evidence, is this. Zana and Ethan were first. Investigators believe Ethan fought back, evident by the defensive wounds. Then the killer moved upstairs, where Kaylee and Maddie lay sleeping in the same bed, as they often did on nights like this. They were both stabbed multiple times. The attack was personal, close, brutal, but it wasn't silent. Dylan, one of the surviving roommates, would later tell police she thought she heard crying. She opened her door and saw a masked man in black walk past her and out of the house. Frozen by fear, she locked her door and went back into her room, she would not call 911 until hours later, just before noon, after waking to a house filled with blood and unanswered phones. The call that came in was chaotic, confused. The dispatcher logged it as unconscious person. But what awaited first responders was a crime scene so horrific, seasoned officers would later admit it was one of the worst they'd ever encountered. Blood seeped through walls. The dog, Murphy, was unharmed, locked in another room. The town of Moscow would never be the same. Word spread like wildfire. In small towns, news travels fast. But in college towns, it spreads in whispers and Instagram stories. Panic swelled. Who would do this? Was it random? A serial killer? Was someone targeting Greek life? The Moscow Police Department, with help from Idaho State Police and the FBI, launched a massive investigation. But with no suspect, no weapon, and a shaken community demanding answers, the pressure mounted fast. Thousands of tips poured in. Surveillance footage was gathered from the area. One key piece emerged, a white Hyundai Elantra seen near the house around 4 a.m. It was traced backward through video footage, street by street, mile by mile. The FBI labored day and night, chasing any lead. Still, no arrests were made for weeks. National media descended on the town. Commentators speculated. Families grieved on live television. And then, silence. Until the DNA investigators found a tan leather knife sheath left on Maddie's bed, under her body. On the snap was a single touch of DNA, so faint it had to be run through a special lab using advanced genealogical methods. That lab led them to a family member, and from there, to a name. Brian Christopher Koberger. At the time of the murders, Koberger was a PhD student at Washington State University, just 10 miles away from Moscow. He studied criminal justice with a particular interest in the psychology of killers. He'd even conducted a research survey asking former criminals how they chose victims and got away with crimes. On paper, he was intelligent, reserved, socially awkward perhaps, but nothing that screamed murderer. Still, detectives watched him for weeks. They saw him clean his white Hyundai Elantra with surgical precision. They retrieved DNA from trash at his parents' house in Pennsylvania, where he returned for winter break. It matched the DNA on the knife sheath. On December 30th, 2022, Brian Koberger was arrested in the early morning hours by a SWAT team. The mugshot showed a gaunt, pale face with sunken eyes. The nation exhaled, some in relief, others in horror. Who was this man, and why had he done it? As the trial loomed, new questions emerged. Koberger had been in the area. His phone pinged near the King Road house 12 times before the murders. Once, even at 9 a.m. the next morning, possibly returning to the scene. But no motive has ever been officially released. Was it obsession, revenge, a psychotic break? Some say he fixated on Maddie or Kaylee. Others claim he wanted to prove he could outsmart the system. His defense team maintains his innocence. His family says they're shocked. In 2025, over 2 years after the murders, Koberger now stands on the edge of a plea deal. If accepted, it would spare him the death penalty, avoiding a trial that the victims' families had hoped would reveal the full truth. But would that truth ever come? Or would the mystery of what happened that night on King Road die with the silence that followed? Before they were faces in candlelight vigils, before they were names spoken by news anchors and prosecutors, they were just kids. Young adults navigating life, friendships, and the messy, beautiful journey of becoming. To tell this story without honoring them would be to lose the humanity behind the horror. They were not statistics. They were vibrant souls. Kaylee Goncalves was the kind of person who walked into a room and lit it up without trying. A senior majoring in general studies, she had just landed a job with a tech company in Austin and was planning a move to Texas in the new year. Kaylee was bright, fiercely loyal, and unfiltered in the best way. She was the type of friend who would laugh with you in your worst moments and fight for you in your silent ones. Her relationship with Madison Mogan was legendary among their peers, two halves of the same whole. Kaylee had recently come home to Moscow for the weekend just to show Maddie her new Range Rover and spend time with her childhood best friend. It was meant to be a quick visit, a goodbye of sorts before her next chapter. She had her dog, Murphy, and a future packed with promise. She would never see that chapter. Madison Maddie Mogan, also a senior, was majoring in marketing. She had long blonde hair, a quick wit, and a love of photography. Maddie had been dating a fellow student and had a deep connection with her family, especially her stepfather, who helped raise her. She was smart, stylish, and had a quiet strength about her. Friends described Maddie as a protector. She wasn't loud, but she noticed everything. She had a calm confidence, the kind that made people feel safe. She and Kaylee had been best friends since sixth grade. From childhood to college, they grew up together. Even in their final moments, they were side by side. There's a haunting comfort in that. Zana Kernodle was just 20, a junior majoring in marketing. She was fun, funny, and had a signature sarcasm that made people laugh out loud. Born in Arizona but raised in Idaho, she had a younger sister and a mother who described her as fiercely independent. She loved music, road trips, and nights in just as much as parties. She worked at a local restaurant called Mad Greek with Maddie, where they often pulled double shifts and made customers feel like family. Zana was dating Ethan Chapin, and theirs was the kind of love that felt effortless. They were the couple that never made a big deal about being a couple. They just fit. Ethan Chapin, also 20, was tall, goofy, and beloved by all who knew him. He was a triplet, one of three siblings who had all enrolled at the University of Idaho together. He played basketball in high school and was a member of the Sigma Chi fraternity. He had a smile that made people trust him instantly. Ethan was the kind of guy who held the door open, asked how your mom was doing, and actually waited for the answer. He had spent the night at Zana's house, a routine sleepover. They were both exhausted from the party earlier, looking forward to sleeping in and maybe getting breakfast in the morning. They would never get the chance. In the days following the murders, grief blanketed Moscow like a winter fog. A town known for its low crime rate, where students walked freely at night and houses rarely locked their doors, was now on edge. Memorials popped up across campus, flowers, letters, candles, a row of pictures in front of the Sigma Chi house. Murals appeared downtown with their names painted in bold colors. Students clutched each other on sidewalks. Professors canceled classes. The air changed, and the silence was deafening. The families grieved publicly, standing bravely in front of news cameras. Kaylee's parents spoke out the most, demanding answers, calling out the lack of early information from law enforcement. They weren't angry. They were devastated. Desperate. Their daughter had been planning her future. Now they were planning her funeral. Ethan's family created scholarships. Zana's family withdrew into privacy. Maddie's family issued statements filled with heartbreak and grace. All four families stood united at candlelight vigils, huddled under coats and blankets in the Idaho cold, surrounded by classmates and strangers who came to mourn. The pain stretched far beyond Moscow. It hit college campuses across the country. Parents began texting their kids more often. Dorms that had once felt like home suddenly felt unsafe. Students started walking in groups again, because if it could happen in a place like Moscow, it could happen anywhere. The loss was not just personal, it was generational. What made this case especially cruel wasn't just the violence. It was the randomness, the lack of motive, the idea that a person could plan something this horrific, carry it out in silence, and walk away unnoticed into the night. The victims were asleep. They were in their own home. They were surrounded by friends. By every reasonable standard, they should have been safe. And that's what makes their story so haunting. Because it wasn't just about who died. It was about how. About the betrayal of comfort, the violation of sanctuary, about a man who studied crime, then committed it, who watched, stalked, planned and executed with surgical cruelty. Brian Koberger, the alleged killer, hadn't known the victims personally, at least not in any way the public understands. He wasn't in their classes. He wasn't in their friend groups. And yet, something had drawn him there. Some unspoken obsession, some dark curiosity, some twisted logic only he understands. But this chapter doesn't belong to him. It belongs to Kaylee, Maddie, Zana, and Ethan, to the lives they lived and the futures they deserved. As the nation continues to process the events of that night, the University of Idaho has since awarded posthumous degrees to the victims. The house on King Road, once filled with laughter and light, was eventually demolished, not to erase the past, but to protect the future. It was too painful to let it stand, too sacred to be sold or rented again. The memory of what happened there will never fade, but neither will the memory of who they were, Brian Christopher Koberger, a name that would go from obscurity to infamy overnight. When police announced his arrest in connection to the Idaho student murders, the country froze. Not because he looked like a monster, but because he didn't. No prior convictions, no public outbursts, no online threats. Just a quiet 28-year-old criminology student with hollow eyes, a monotone voice, and a life that, on paper, seemed ordinary. But behind that still exterior was a man with unsettling contradictions, and a possible obsession with control, intellect, and human behavior that had gone unnoticed for years. Brian Koberger was born in Albrightsville, Pennsylvania. He grew up in a modest home in the Pocono Mountains, raised by two parents who both worked in public schools. He had an older sister and was described in his yearbook as awkward but smart. Some former classmates remembered a quiet kid. Others recalled someone who was bullied, and then started bullying others. At one point, Brian reportedly struggled with heroin addiction during his teen years. He later got clean, graduated, and enrolled in community college. He eventually earned a bachelor's degree in psychology and a master's in criminal justice from DeSales University. He wrote papers on the minds of criminals, studied forensic psychology, and even worked as a teaching assistant. His master's thesis? A survey sent to ex-convicts asking detailed questions about how they planned and executed crimes, how they selected victims, avoided detection, and what emotions they felt before, during, and after. It was chilling in retrospect. But what made him apply for a PhD program in Pullman, Washington, just 10 miles from Moscow, Idaho? That question would become central to understanding how he ended up in the lives of four strangers who had never met him. At Washington State University, Koberger was a first-year PhD student in criminology. He studied under experts in forensic analysis and digital surveillance. His classmates noticed his intense nature. He was formal, precise, and sometimes domineering in discussions. He corrected others often. He demanded to be taken seriously. Some described him as brilliant. Others found him cold, even arrogant. But no one thought he was dangerous. Brian was reportedly vegan, hyper-disciplined, and extremely routine-oriented. He kept odd hours, often awake late into the night. He'd show up to class with questions that felt like arguments. He asked about technology used in tracking criminal suspects. He asked about cell tower data, about how law enforcement connects people to scenes using digital trails. It would all become eerily relevant later. In the weeks leading up to the murders, surveillance footage and cell data revealed something disturbing. Brian had driven past the King Road house at least a dozen times before November 13th. He wasn't just familiar with the area. He was monitoring it. He was watching them. After the murders, Koberger returned to class like nothing happened. He graded papers. He even reportedly became more vocal, challenging classmates about criminal profiling. He told someone that he believed criminals often leave behind a signature at a crime scene, even unintentionally. All the while, police were closing in on him. The white Hyundai Elantra seen near the crime scene at 4:04 a.m. on the night of the murders, it matched his. Surveillance footage showed it leaving Pullman around 2:45 a.m., arriving in the King Road area by 4 a.m., and leaving shortly after 4:20. His phone? It went dark during that time, turned off or put in airplane mode. But when it came back online, it pinged south of Moscow, heading away from the crime scene. Then came the DNA. The knife sheath left under Madison's body, possibly dropped in a struggle, held a trace of male DNA. Not enough for a standard match, but using genealogical databases and advanced lab work, they traced it to Koberger's family. Once police gathered DNA from his parents' trash in Pennsylvania, it confirmed the match. They had their man. Still, the motive remained unclear. Did he know the victims? Did he follow them on social media? Was he fixated on one of them? There were rumors he messaged one of the girls on Instagram. No replies, but nothing definitive was ever released to the public. And then there was the knife. The weapon used, a large military-style K-bar knife, was never found. But Brian had studied knife-related crime scenes in his coursework. He would have known what to expect, what to avoid, what to clean. He reportedly wore gloves in public after the killings, even while grocery shopping. There were no signs of panic, no confessions, no slips of guilt, just eerie calm. When Koberger was arrested at his parents' home on December 30, 2022, he didn't resist. He reportedly asked if anyone else had been arrested. His demeanor was flat, almost rehearsed, like a man living in a narrative he had studied for years. Investigators found his car, cleaned thoroughly, carpets removed, his phone, reset multiple times, his computer, wiped. But not perfectly. Enough remained for digital forensic teams to build a timeline. Search histories, root data, the pattern of a mind spiraling into obsession and then action. When he appeared in court, the courtroom was silent. Families of the victim sat just feet away, watching the man accused of shattering their lives. He didn't look at them. He showed no emotion, no apology, no fear. Brian Koberger now awaits his fate in an Idaho jail, charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of felony burglary. His defense team argues there are gaps in the case. They point to the absence of a murder weapon, the lack of eyewitness identification, the possibility of contaminated evidence. But with DNA, surveillance, phone records, and behavioral patterns pointing to him, the prosecution built a powerful case. And now, in a stunning development in 2025, he is expected to plead guilty in exchange for life in prison. No trial, no cross-examination, no full truth. Just a quiet ending for a crime that shattered the illusion of safety for an entire generation. But the story isn't over, because we're left with the bigger question. Not just how, but why? What made Brian Koberger cross that line? And were there warning signs we all missed? The house on 1122 King Road stood quietly beneath the gray sky that morning, just as it had the night before. But inside, it was anything but quiet. By the time officers arrived on November 13, 2022, at approximately 11:58 a.m., the front door had already been opened by one of the surviving roommates. What they found would haunt even the most seasoned officers for the rest of their lives. This was not a burglary. Nothing was stolen. There were no signs of forced entry. The scene, instead, spoke of rage, control, and careful planning. But also of mistakes. Let's walk through the nightmare investigators encountered. The house was a split-level structure with 3 floors and multiple entry points. The main entry most students used was a sliding glass door on the 2nd level, accessible from the back. This door, as it turned out, was likely how the suspect entered. The bodies of Zana Kernodle and Ethan Chapin were discovered on the 2nd floor. Ethan's was found in the hallway just outside Zana's bedroom, indicating he had likely tried to intervene. Autopsy reports later revealed that Ethan had defensive wounds, bruises, and cuts to his arms and hands. He had fought. Inside the bedroom, Zana lay near the edge of the bed. Her wounds were described as severe. Based on autopsy timing and the coroner's early notes, investigators believed she was awake during the attack. That detail would torment her family forever. On the third floor, Kaylee Goncalves and Madison Mogan were found in the same bed. There were no signs of forced restraint. No screams had been reported, but later, a nearby surveillance camera from a neighboring home would capture faint whimpering and a dog barking at 4:17 a.m. What was left behind in that room was a single, crucial clue, a tan leather K-bar knife sheath, the kind used in military training or survival situations. Stamped on it were the initials USMC, United States Marine Corps. It lay partially under Maddie's body. It would become the thread that unraveled everything. Downstairs, the two surviving roommates, Dylan and Bethany, were still asleep, or at least unaware of the full scope of what had occurred. One of them, Dylan, later told investigators that she had heard crying. She opened her bedroom door three separate times during the early morning hours. At one point, she saw a man dressed in black, wearing a mask that covered his nose and mouth, walking toward the back sliding door. He was tall, athletically built, with bushy eyebrows. Frozen in shock and fear, she closed her door and locked it. She didn't call 911 immediately, either out of fear, disbelief, or trauma. It wasn't until the following morning, when friends of the victims arrived at the house and realized something was wrong, that the 911 call was placed. The call was made from inside the house using one of the surviving roommates' phones, but to this day, law enforcement has not released the full contents of that conversation. What they did find, once they entered, was a bloodbath. Blood had seeped through the walls, it pooled onto the floors and dripped down the sides of the house. Crime scene photos, though never released in full, were described as gruesome and unprecedented by officials. Some responding officers needed therapy after what they saw. Investigators knew they had to work quickly, but also with extreme precision. They collected over 113 pieces of physical evidence from the house. This included bedding, hair, fibers, fingerprints, and digital devices. The scene was processed for over a week. Forensics teams used chemical agents to detect latent blood and DNA traces invisible to the naked eye. The knife sheath, however, stood out from the rest. On its button clasp, they recovered a single male DNA profile, one not in any law enforcement database. That meant it hadn't been collected before, but it was clean enough to run through a genealogical database. Meanwhile, surveillance footage from local businesses and homes created a digital web. One camera caught the white Hyundai Elantra circling the neighborhood multiple times between 3:30 and 4:20 a.m. on the night of the murders. It parked, then vanished down a side road. With each new camera angle, they tracked its path, eventually tracing it all the way back to Pullman, Washington, where Brian Koberger lived. Koberger's phone data added another layer to the puzzle. According to court documents, his device had pinged near the King Road home at least 12 times prior to the murders. All but one of those pings happened late at night or early in the morning. On the night of the murders, his phone was shut off, or placed on airplane mode, around 2:47 a.m., and turned back on again just before 5 a.m. near Blaine, Idaho, heading south. That gap of silence aligned perfectly with the time of the murders. The digital map was complete. Still, the prosecution needed more. They tracked Koberger's movements after the murders. He cleaned his car, replaced the trash, and avoided his usual routines. Investigators followed him across the country to Pennsylvania, where he was visiting family for the holidays. A surveillance team collected trash from the Koberger household and sent it to a lab. The results were conclusive. The DNA matched the profile from the knife sheath. Investigators now had a direct line from the crime scene to Koberger's family, and from there, to Koberger himself. It was enough for an arrest warrant. On December 30, 2022, Brian Koberger was arrested in Albrightsville, Pennsylvania, without incident. In his possession were gloves, plastic bags, and other items authorities believed were part of a cleanup protocol. His white Hyundai Elantra was seized. His phone and laptop were confiscated. His demeanor during the arrest was cold, flat, and eerily calm. When he was extradited back to Idaho, he said little. When asked by reporters outside the courthouse if he had anything to say to the victims' families, he stared ahead in silence. The house at 1122 King Road would sit untouched for months, the crime scene sealed, the doors locked. Eventually, the University of Idaho announced plans to demolish it, a decision met with mixed emotions. For some, it was a necessary step toward healing. For others, it felt like burying a truth that still needed light. But no one could erase the memories. The bedrooms, the hallway, the silent witness of walls soaked in blood and fear. For investigators, it was a crime scene. For the families, it was the last place their children lived. And for the rest of the world, it became a chilling reminder that even in the safest places, darkness sometimes walks in without knocking. In a crime this brutal, many assumed it would take eyewitnesses or physical evidence to solve it. But in the end, the case against Brian Koberger began to come together not through screaming alarms or bloody footprints, but through silent signals left behind in digital space. The killer may have been methodical. He may have worn gloves, turned off his phone, and cleaned his car. But what he didn't count on was the modern world's memory. Every car camera, cell tower, and GPS ping had something to say. And those silent witnesses began to talk. The FBI's elite behavioral analysis unit and digital forensics team were brought in within days of the murders. With no suspect and a community on edge, they combed the entire area for surveillance footage. Everything from traffic lights to gas station cameras, ATM kiosks, even doorbell cameras. They discovered footage showing a white Hyundai Elantra circling the neighborhood around 3:30 to 4:20 a.m., the night of the murders. The car passed the King Road house multiple times, making slow loops, each pass more deliberate than the last. The exact make and model wasn't immediately known, but analysts narrowed it down using headlight reflections and wheelbase ratios. It was a 2011 to 2013 Hyundai Elantra. Investigators began scouring Department of Motor Vehicles databases, college parking permits, and nearby surveillance networks. Hundreds of Elantras were identified, but only one belonged to a man who lived 10 miles away, drove alone at night, and had previously studied criminal behavior. Brian Koberger. Meanwhile, cell tower data was being collected in overlapping zones across Moscow and Pullman. Every phone that pinged near the King Road residence between 3:30 and 5 a.m. was flagged. Koberger's phone had a peculiar pattern. On most days, his phone followed predictable movements: school, apartment, grocery store. But on November 13th, it told a different story. The phone went dark at 2:47 a.m., either powered off, placed in airplane mode, or intentionally disabled. This blackout occurred just minutes before the white Elantra was caught on camera heading toward King Road. At 4:48 a.m., the phone came back online, this time pinging miles away, heading south through rural roads toward Lewiston. The implication was clear. Brian had intentionally turned off his device to avoid detection during the time of the murders. But what he didn't realize was that the cell data still painted a timeline. A trail of where he wasn't could be just as revealing as where he was. Data analysts pulled historical cell records dating back months. They found that Koberger's phone had pinged near the victim's house at least 12 times before the murders, usually late at night or early in the morning. Once might have been coincidence. 12 times suggested surveillance. Investigators began suspecting that Koberger had been casing the house, driving by, watching, studying the layout, the patterns of who came and went, waiting for the right moment. And then came a chilling detail. The day after the murders, on November 13th at 9:12 a.m., Koberger's phone pinged again near the crime scene. Had he returned to see what the police were doing, or just to relive what he had done? Digital forensics didn't stop there. Investigators pulled data from Brian's laptop and searched his internet history. Though much of it had been wiped or encrypted, fragments remained. Articles about the case, news footage, Reddit threads, how-to guides on DNA, cell tracking, and the movement of law enforcement after homicides. They discovered that Brian had previously posted on Reddit as part of his master's research, asking former criminals questions like, "How did you leave the scene? What did you do to prevent getting caught? What was your mindset before and after the crime?" At the time, it looked like academic curiosity. Now, it looked like preparation. Perhaps the most damning digital mistake Brian made was trying to erase his tracks too late. When he was arrested, investigators seized his devices. His laptop had been recently wiped. His phone's cache was cleared. But even with deletion, some data always lingers, especially on cloud backups, internet providers, and Wi-Fi routers. He had even removed the floor mats and trunk lining from his Elantra. Lab tests revealed faint traces of blood in the car, though it wasn't enough for a full DNA profile. Still, combined with everything else, it pointed toward someone who had planned this not just to kill, but to disappear. But Brian was not invisible. He was not perfect. And the digital world never truly forgets. One strange pattern investigators noticed was Koberger's online behavior in the weeks after the murders. While outwardly returning to class and grading papers, Brian was quietly searching for updates on the investigation. His Google history showed late-night queries like Idaho Murders Update, King Road Police Activity, and How Close is Pullman to Moscow Police Jurisdiction? It was almost like he couldn't stop watching the story unfold, like he needed to know what they knew, and maybe how close they were getting. In many ways, it was his obsession with control that became his undoing. He thought he was smarter than the system, that studying criminology would make him immune to capture, that deleting data and avoiding direct confrontation would keep him safe. But modern policing is no longer just about fingerprints and footprints. It's about behavior patterns, data trails, and digital breadcrumbs. And once those pieces start connecting, even the quietest killer can't hide forever. By the time Brian Koberger was arrested, the digital evidence told a clear, compelling story. He had been watching. He had planned. He had returned. And despite his silence, the data spoke louder than he ever could. The arrest of Brian Koberger marked the end of one chapter, but the beginning of another, far more complicated one. Now came the trial. Or at least that was the expectation. Families waited. Prosecutors built a case. The public wanted answers. But what followed was months of legal maneuvering, silence, and a frustrating game of chess. From the start, Koberger's defense strategy raised eyebrows, and as the proceedings unfolded, it became clear this wasn't going to be a normal case. This was a legal storm, and no one would walk away untouched. Brian Koberger made his first court appearance on January 5, 2023, in Lata County, Idaho. Shackled at the waist and ankles, dressed in an orange jumpsuit, he stood silently as the judge read out the charges. 4 counts of first-degree murder and 1 count of felony burglary. He didn't enter a plea at the time. Instead, he agreed to be extradited from Pennsylvania voluntarily, a move his attorneys described as a show of cooperation. But cooperation was not what followed. Koberger's public defender, a seasoned attorney from Kootenai County named Ann Taylor, quickly began filing motions, dozens of them. Motions to limit evidence, motions to restrict public access, motions challenging everything from the DNA analysis to the search warrant process. From the outside, it looked like a standard defense strategy. Throw everything at the wall and see what sticks. But behind the scenes, it was clear they were buying time. Time to examine the massive trove of digital, forensic, and testimonial evidence gathered by the prosecution. Time to look for any mistake, any break in the chain of custody, any detail that could raise reasonable doubt. And time, most of all, to delay the trial. The victims' families, meanwhile, waited in anguish. Kaylee Goncalves' father, Steve, became one of the most vocal advocates for justice. He appeared on national television, spoke at vigils, and demanded transparency from prosecutors and police. He wanted a trial. He wanted the world to hear every detail of what happened to his daughter. But trials are slow, and this one, with its complexity and media coverage, was slower than most. Preliminary hearings were scheduled, then postponed. Discovery deadlines were pushed. Mental health evaluations were debated. The defense requested sealed documents, claiming threats against Koberger's safety and an unfair media environment. The judge, in an effort to ensure a fair trial, issued a sweeping gag order, limiting what prosecutors, law enforcement, and even the victims' families could say publicly. What had once been a high-profile case now fell into a legal blackout. Then came a bombshell. The death penalty was on the table. Prosecutors announced that they intended to pursue capital punishment if Koberger were found guilty. The decision added weight to every move. Death penalty cases require a higher threshold of evidence, a longer pretrial process, and a heavier emotional toll on all involved. Defense attorneys now faced a difficult choice: fight the case and risk execution, or push for a deal. Behind closed doors, negotiations began. And in mid-2025, whispers of a possible plea deal leaked to the press. The terms? Koberger would plead guilty to all charges in exchange for life in prison without the possibility of parole. No trial, no appeals, no death sentence. For many, the offer felt like a relief, a guaranteed conviction, a spared expense of years of litigation, closure. But for others, especially the victims' families, it felt like a betrayal. Steve Goncalves, speaking through intermediaries, said the plea deal was a hard no. He wanted the world to see the evidence, to hear the details, to hold Koberger accountable in the most public way possible. Other families were more divided. Some preferred avoiding the trauma of reliving the crime in court. Others feared Koberger's defense team would exploit minor inconsistencies to sow doubt and escape punishment altogether. And still, a deeper question remained. Would a plea deal mean the full truth would never come out? Because in a courtroom trial, every detail becomes public record, every motive explored, every mistake laid bare. But in a plea deal, much of that stays sealed. We might never hear why he did it. We might never know if he stalked Kaylee, if he targeted Maddie, if Zana and Ethan were collateral or part of a deeper plan. A courtroom forces confession through confrontation. A plea deal locks the door before the public ever walks in. Legally, a guilty plea would mean life in prison, no chance of release. Koberger would die behind bars. He would never speak to the media. He would never explain himself unless he chose to in a private letter or courtroom statement. But morally, some argued, it felt unfinished. No public apology, no remorse. Just the quiet end of a monstrous chapter. And so, the debate rages. Is closure more important than clarity? Is sparing the families from years of trial worth never fully understanding why? Is life in prison enough for someone accused of stalking, studying, and slaughtering four people in their own home? No answer satisfies everyone. Not the courts, not the victims' families, not the public. As of July 2025, Koberger's guilty plea is expected to be finalized in the coming weeks. The courtroom will be full that day, of reporters, law enforcement, and families clutching photographs of loved ones taken too soon. Koberger will likely say few words. A judge will read the charges aloud, one by one, and when asked how he pleads, he'll simply say, "Guilty." No trial, no testimony, just silence. And maybe, just maybe, an end. But justice is never that simple, because in the hearts of those left behind, the wounds remain. Not just from what was done, but from what was never said. By the time the courtroom emptied and the cameras rolled away, it felt like the world had moved on. Headlines faded. Journalists packed up. Brian Koberger, now a convicted murderer, disappeared into the system, life without parole. No more court dates, no more delays, just concrete walls, a steel bed, and the rest of his days to reflect, or not. But for those who lived through it, there is no moving on, only living with what's left. In Moscow, Idaho, the seasons continued to change. Snow melted, classes resumed, new students enrolled at the University of Idaho, many of them too young to remember where they were when the murders happened. But the shadows of that night still stretch across campus. The once vibrant off-campus house at 1122 King Road was demolished in late 2023. It took just hours to bring it down, but the debate over what should be done with the space lasted for months. Some wanted it preserved as a memorial, others said it was too painful to see. In the end, the decision was made quietly. Bulldozers came early one morning. No fanfare, no public event, just silence. As if the town itself wanted to erase what had happened. But trauma doesn't follow demolition schedules. It lingers. Students still avoid that hill. Neighbors still double-lock their doors. And every November, people leave flowers where the house once stood. The families continue to grieve, each in their own way. Kaylee's father, Steve Goncalves, remains outspoken. He's turned his grief into advocacy, demanding reform in how small-town police departments handle major crimes. He has also worked to launch a scholarship fund in Kaylee's name, one that helps young women pursue careers in criminal justice. Madison's family honors her through an arts and photography grant, reflecting her passion for creativity. They've mostly stayed out of the media spotlight, choosing to protect her memory quietly. Zana's family set up a foundation focused on domestic safety and women's protection. Her younger sister, once too young to understand what happened, now speaks at events across the state, urging young women to trust their instincts and look out for each other. And Ethan Chapin's family created a living legacy, the Ethan's Smile Foundation, which supports youth sports and mental health resources. His mother once said, "Ethan had the biggest smile in every room. If we can help one kid feel safe again, that's how we keep him alive." The families have been united in pain, but divided by the plea deal. Some wanted a trial. Others were relieved to avoid it. But all agree on one thing. They deserved answers they'll never get. Why did he do it? Why them? And why, despite all the red flags, did no one stop him? For investigators, the case changed everything. Moscow police, once criticized for delays and secrecy, now run updated training programs in trauma-informed response and digital evidence collection. The FBI has since released internal reports citing the Idaho case as an example of multi-agency success, but also a lesson in the urgency of communication. Pullman, Washington, home of Washington State University, reassessed how it monitors student behavior and psychological health. Brian Koberger's professors never saw him as violent, but they did notice he grew more withdrawn, more intense. No one connected the dots in time. The case sparked a national conversation about criminology students and ethical boundaries. How much fascination with murder is too much? And when does studying evil become too close to becoming it? Then there's the internet. The Idaho murders were one of the most heavily dissected crimes on social media in modern history. TikTok sleuths, Reddit theorists, YouTube commentators all tried to solve the case in real time. Some helped, most didn't. Conspiracy theories bloomed. Innocent people were harassed. The two surviving roommates were accused of everything from cover-ups to murder. Online speculation blurred fact and fiction, truth and trauma. In the end, it became clear. Real life is not a true crime podcast. There are no guaranteed answers, only real victims, real pain, and real consequences. And Brian Koberger? He now lives in isolation at the Idaho State Correctional Institution, 23 hours a day in a small concrete cell. No contact with the general population, no internet, no books on criminology. Just court-mandated therapy, mail that's reviewed, and the haunting quiet of a mind left alone. He has not spoken publicly. He has not apologized. He has not explained. Some believe he wanted to be famous. Others believe he wanted control. And some think he simply wanted to prove that he was smarter than everyone else. But in the end, he was not a genius, not a mastermind, not even original, just another coward who studied monsters until he became one. And yet, there's still something deeper this case leaves behind, a question we all now carry. What does justice really look like? Is it a guilty plea? A lifetime in prison? A name forgotten? Or is it remembering the victims not for how they died, but how they lived? Kaylee, Madison, Zana, Ethan. They laughed, they danced, they dreamed, and they mattered. Their story is not about the man who took their lives. It's about the light they gave the world before he ever stepped into it. That's the part no killer can ever touch.